So I think you have an appreciation now for how this taking aspects of the mind as the path is right on the brink of Vipassana practice, and how the two of them can be fused very easily without the fusion becoming, you know, wildly conceptual anyway. But there certainly is a role to play in Mahamudra and Dzogchen for analysis for that kind of Vipassana, but we're not really going to do that in this retreat. We have done that in other times, but we're not going to do that now, because we're just really working on this one little practice of simultaneous stillness and motion. And then just examining really what you can do with that one practice, and really do some really meaningful practice that could just kind of blur the boundaries between non-meditation and simultaneous stillness and motion. Non-meditation being what the practice that you're not doing when you're resting in pristine awareness. So as Padmasambhava said, this approach that he advocates and teaches is introducing the view by way of meditation. So we are just doing our practice, and then the view just kind of ambushes you. It really lets you, it just creeps into your practice and then becomes perhaps a realization. So for those who have experienced this identification of Rigpa, then the question becomes, how do you sustain it? Now that you have a taste of it, what is it that you do to make this a more common experience? Because I think it seems to me that peak experiences are common. That people, probably everybody in this room, has had a peak experience of non-duality. You know, so something happened to you spontaneously. So that's the thing. It happened spontaneously. You weren't working on it, and it didn't come as the culmination of, you know, a lot of grit and effort. And then at the end of that, the reward was this big illumination. But I would guess that, and a lot of you are smiling, you know exactly what I'm talking about, that at some time in your life, and it may have been only once, that you had this, what? You know, call it a peak experience, but it was an experience of non-duality. The clouds parted. And you felt, a lot of people would just report this intuition of wholeness, unity, expansiveness, transcendence of ego, all that stuff, right? So the first thing that always happens when you have that kind of experience is to cling to it and think, you know, and the natural instinct is like, this is a life raft and I'm out in the ocean. And maybe if the key to keeping this around is by really grasping to it and clinging, holding on tight. And so we have a memory of it. And then maybe what happens too is you begin to identify yourself with it and say, now I've got it made. My life is different because now I am a person who has had that experience. And then you cling to that identity. And then as the days and weeks roll by, the freshness of that experience begins to fade. And then you just begin to prove to yourself over and over and over again that you really haven't changed much because of it. It can. Sometimes these experiences can have the power to just really shock you and turn you 180 degrees. And, you know, that has the power to do that. But then, you know, then what? The question then is, when you have this experience and, you know, you do these practices, just as we're outlining here, you do these practices and you're going to have this experience, and maybe you have had this experience of Rigpa, of pristine awareness. And Dujam Lingpa had that happen also. This seems almost implausible now, you know, looking at the autobiography that we've been just sampling the last couple of nights and what we already know about him. But in his spiritual memoir of Mud and Feathers, he talks about actually something that's more common to our experience, where he would have long, maybe not so common, he would have long experiences of pristine awareness, where he would rest in it, pristine awareness, and he would describe exactly what that was like. And then he would say, but on the other hand, there were occasions when I would be alone in the wilderness with the howling savages and the wild beasts, and then I would become afraid. And that mental affliction of fear made me just like an ordinary sentient being. And what hope if I was just naked and alone in the howling wilderness and I became afraid? What chance would I have then of actually seeing the clear light in the bardo? Yes. If I become afraid of these dream images, the bardo images are really going to terrify me. So this was the situation that he found himself in. And then at that point, Orgyen Dorje Drolo, a wrathful manifestation of Padmasambhava, appeared to him and sang the Hum Hum song, and which is really extraordinary. That would be a good one to set to music. So the Hum Hum song is a couple of pages in, sometimes I think it's in Buddhahood Without Meditation, but it's actually in Mud and Feathers, I'm almost sure of it. But the point of the Hum Hum song is to give Dujam Lingpa advice about how to stabilize Rigpa. Once you have the experience of Rigpa, how is it that you actually then make this your everyday experience, stabilize? How, basically, in the terms of developmental psychology, how do you turn a peak experience, so we've all had those, how do you turn that into a state and to become a trait? So that this becomes your everyday, every hour, every moment way of perceiving reality. You just live there. This becomes your center of gravity. So the advice, and just interesting to think that the Orgyen Dorje Drolo, who appeared, remember in the very first evening, Padmasambhava told Dujam Lingpa, you are going to become the wisdom emanation of Orgyen Dorje Drolo. So here you have Orgyen Dorje Drolo appearing to his own wisdom emanation and giving him advice. The advice that he gives him is vipassana practice. So the way that you stabilize your experience of Rigpa is with eliminating the final vestiges of grasping to self-existence of I and other and phenomena. And so he gave him, in particular, three practices. And the first two of these are about emptiness, and the third one then is, I don't know, the view from pristine awareness. So the first of these is, and both of these, you know, if you're really looking for solid bedrock vipassana practices, but that are not the whole galukpa, you know, corpus of 1,000 different ways of analyzing emptiness. If you're really looking for something that is tailored right for the job that we're doing here. These two are really, really excellent. And these you can do on the fly. You don't have to be sitting on a cushion. You can be doing these out in the heat of battle when mental afflictions arise, or you're walking down the street, or you're just walking out here. You can be doing these Vipassana practices that this nomad gave us, that Orgyen Dorje Drolo gave the nomad, are really just something that you can have always at your fingertips. So the first of these is seek out the source of names. So this has quickly become, you know, as soon as I was introduced to this, this became my favorite Vipassana meditation. And so the Dujam Lengpa describes this by investigating and analyzing the tenacious grasping of saying the name I and grasping at the thought I am, you find that the basis of designation of everything is non-objective and empty. And in other settings, we've done, you know, Wonderwell, we did that, in other retreats, done that. And I think at Cape Ann, we did that also. You know, really focus on this as a standalone practice for one or two sessions, because it's really powerful. And so you basically are just asking, what is the referent of X? What is the referent of Jarrett? What is the referent of I? What is the referent of teacup? So you have a thing, an object, or an entity, you could call it. So what is the basis of designation of that? Or what is the referent of that? So you basically, first of all, you call to mind, what is this thing? What is the ref? What do I mean? And especially the powerful one is I. What is the referent of I? And then what is the basis of designation of this I? The I means something. It is a label that is pasted onto something. So what is this I? And then the two obvious possibilities are the body and the mind. You know, I am the body and the mind. And so you ask, well, what is the body? You know, well, the body is my nose, my ears, my smile, my eyes. The eyes are the window of the soul, right? So maybe it's that. You know, it's in my mind, it's a picture of 30 years ago, who I am. and, you know, so you just ask, what is the basis of designation of this I? And then you keep finding that every time that this basis of designation, you don't find the thing that you're analyzing in the basis of designation, because the basis of designation is empty. And it is not, so what is the body? It is only, again, another name pasted on other bases of designation, and it turtles all the way down. So there's that one, and we're not going to go into that because there are other things we're going to spend our afternoon on. But and then destroy grasping at the permanence of things. So this one is just an instant emptiness meditation. So all you have to know is that if something is changing, if something is impermanent, it is empty. If something is permanent, or if something is inherently existent, it must be permanent. Because it can't be a changing thing, it can't be open to other influence of causes and conditions, all of that. So this was bedrock, and is bedrock, Majjhimaka, coming from Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna. I get confused, you know, so there. Ellen says Nagarjuna, and we used to say Nagarjuna, so I forget, but it's Nagarjuna, and His Holiness says Nagarjuna, I think. You know, all the Dharamsala people say Nagarjuna. so if something is permanent, Or if something is impermanent, you have just proven, and you observe its impermanence, you have just proven its emptiness. So all you have to do when something, and then you realize, again, you know, for this is the handy antidote for mental afflictions, because mental afflictions always depend on two things, and you can check this out in your own experience. If you're feeling mentally afflicted, the one thing necessary is exaggeration, or you could say the refractory period, in Paul Ekman's terms. So something you're attached to, you see only its good qualities, you know, all of its loving, lovable qualities, all of its attractive qualities. The reason that you must have it is because it's the one pure thing in the world, you know. And so if you have this thing, it will be a source of happiness for you. And on the other hand, if something is upsetting you or pissing you off, that thing just has qualities, the exaggerated qualities are all of its loathsome qualities. And so I think that, you know, in our contemporary political culture, we see this at work constantly, that these are just unvarnished, unmitigated camps here, that, you know, you are totally horrible. My camp, you know, let's just say is all good or something, if you're really attached, if you're a true believer anyway. So there's that, the exaggeration, and then the reification. So if you're really feeling mentally afflicted, look at the thing that is causing your the so-called cause of your mental affliction, and then just observe it. Is it a changing thing or not? And if you recognize that it is a concept that is causing your disturbance or your attachment, meaning that you are relating to a person conceptually, then you realize that you have found the permanent thing, because concepts are unchanging. Kuntak. But the... So anyway, that those are handy. This is the advice that Orgyen Dorje Drolo gave, these two handy Vipassana practices, with the idea, recognizing that the point is that Vipassana practice is what is going to allow you to cut through the vestiges of grasping that are preventing you, that are obscuring pristine awareness. And even if you've had a glimpse of pristine awareness and you've already identified it, this is what keeps you from spending more time there. And we will come to the third element of Orgyen Dorje Drolo's advice in a moment. So I thought it would be interesting as a Vipassana practice. So we have in the Mahamudra and Sokchen that I've been exposed to anyway in the last couple of years, there are a number of Vipassana practices that come up over and over again. And so I've given you these two already, seek out the source of names and destroy grasping at the permanence of things. And then basically in Mahamudra especially, there's a very clear progression of looking at more and more subtle objects, beginning with appearances, and then the mind that is perceiving appearances, the eye, and then awareness itself. With these basic, the Vipassana questions are origin, location, destination. Where do they come from? Where are they? Where do they go? These appearances of these. So there are those. And we've, in other settings, you know, I've gone through those in detail. But I thought it would be an interesting way that occurred to me of thinking about Vipassana and organizing it is just with these instructions and real pointing out instructions that of Wangchuk Dorje. So all appearances are mind. Mind is empty. Emptiness is spontaneous actualization, and spontaneous actualization is self-release or self-liberation. So because those are something that you can really incorporate into your simultaneous stillness and motion of appearances practice, and if you already have the Vipassana elements of these, so if you say mind is empty and you know exactly why, then what occurs to me, and sometime I think I'll do a retreat like this, and it may be I'll do this in the 1 month retreat coming up, include a little bit of Lam Rim type of approach, basically with the idea that you are in the Lam Rim in Appendix F of Volume 2 of the Lam Rim of Lobsang Tarchin, that the whole point is that you reach this uncontrived experiential realization. So you do the Vipassana meditation, the analysis, and what happens is that, so you do the analysis and then you have this shift to non-conceptual meditation. Basically, it's called placement. So you do analytical meditation and then you have this shift. It's a shift from, of mind, but from left hemisphere to right hemisphere correlated with also. So you it's a different, that the placement meditation feels like realization. And before what you were doing was conceptual and analysis. But there's something in doing that that leads to the realization. And then you go back, it doesn't last for long, and then you go back and do the analysis again. And then what happens is that at some point, and this is the way you're supposed to approach the Lam Rim if this is your main practice. You just keep doing that in analytical meditation until you have a spontaneous or a uncontrived experiential realization of the particular topic. And at that point, no more analysis is needed. And the instant that the topic comes to mind, you have the uncontrived experiential realization, meaning it doesn't depend on the analysis. And so in the Lam Rim, the way that it was intended by Atisha, or at least by people that have taught it since, and certainly in Appendix F by Pabanka Rinpoche, is that you just go through the Lam Rim and take your time and just have one uncontrived experiential realization after another, with the easier topics providing the foundation for the later topics. And so wouldn't it be something if you just had a very limited sequence of Vipassana practices, something like all appearances are mind. And so that you did all of the Vipassana analysis necessary to do that, analysis, placement meditation, analysis, placement meditation, analysis, placement meditation, uncontrived experiential realization. Every time the thought, appearances are mind, comes up, it's not conceptual, it's the realization. So imagine if you had only those a few, like these four of Wangchuk Dorje to work on, and you made that a priority to have the uncontrived experiential realization of all of those, and then you are doing the shamatha practice of simultaneous stillness and motion, and appearance arises, and you know how the I was mentioning with subjective and objective appearances that it seems to me that you can, that these are compound appearances. And as you spend more time with it, you can see different facets of the compound all simultaneously. You know, because you don't want to just sit there and examine, oh, from this side it looks like that, but then, oh, you turn it like that and it looks like that. And then let's shift to the subjective appearance, you know, behind the camera and then back, you know, because what you're doing, you've created an abstraction then and analyzing it. But can you actually see all of the different facets of the compound appearance at once? And if you can do that with a subjective and objective appearance, including a sense of I, the observer, for instance, all kind of, and there's, you know, reasons that I say that this is possible, and including His Holiness, kind of hints at this in his presentation of the 52 mental factors, but that's another story. So imagine then if an appearance arises and you see it as a compound appearance, and the facets of the compound are all appearances are mind. Mind is empty. Emptiness is spontaneous actualization. Spontaneous actualization is self-release. And every appearance that appears to you appears like that, all at once. So this is exactly what the vividness, the descriptions of vividness are, that simultaneously, as an appearance arises, you see its nature. And to say, oh, it's empty, is one thing. You know, but what does that actually mean? Is that a whole Vipassana program in one? You know, here you have just this, poo, you know, this is what it all means. So that would be really something, I think. So, Dujam Lengpa then in the, so when we're, yeah, so we're deactivating basically while we're doing this, where you have to give up striving. The one thing that is going to really, remember the final, one of the final obscurations of pristine awareness when you're resting in substrate consciousness is this grasping to, a very subtle grasping to, I am a sentient being who is on the path and trying to cut through to pristine awareness. And so you have to give up that striving because that is what really anchors you as being a sentient being. So Dujam Lingpa was really getting at this with the third of Dorje Drolo's advices to Dujam Lingpa, which is called Collapse the False Cave. And here, Orgyen Dorje Drolo said, I think actually it's Dujam Lingpa here commenting on Orgyen Dorje Drolo's Hum Hum song. So it is anyway under Collapse the False Cave. Even though you recognize the phenomenal world as consisting of mental apparitions, if you grasp at the deluded agent as being internal and the delusive appearance as being external, like an illusion and an illusionist, or a dream and a dreamer, you are tightly bound by chains of dualistic grasping. Instead, know that the conceptualized self that is grasped as I and all its aspects that are established as the external physical world and its internal sentient inhabitants are arising within the expanse of the all-pervasive essential nature of the mind, devoid of a sentry and periphery. So all of these appearances, so this is what we are trying to see, and not just conceptually, but that when these appearances arise, that they actually arise to you as being appearances of mind, that this is mind that you're looking at. All of these appearances are arising within the expanse of all-pervasive essential nature of the mind. Samsara and nirvana are wholly present as your own perceptions, and they are wholly included within the expanse of the essential nature. This essential nature is the ground. So this ground is really, and your experience of resting in the ground is really interesting, I think. What a term. But here's something that may be a little bit nerdy, but I think it's especially for people who have some experience with the new translation schools, so Gelugpa, so everything except Nyingma is called the new translation schools, and there seems to be a movement among scholars these days to call these, to distinguish new translation and old translation schools. And so, like Eva Netanya, who just got a PhD, you know, went through the more kind of most recent iteration of scholarship. And she, you know, really uses this term a lot, new translation schools, old translation schools. So you've got basically the Nyingmas and everybody else. So here then, His Holiness is describing this, a really critical difference between the new translation schools and the old translation schools. And this is, I think, will be really intriguing for those of you who have studied new translation school Tantra and have an idea of what it is that you're trying to do to experience the clear light. So here's His Holiness. And this is, again, from that book, The Heart of Meditation, Discovering Innermost Awareness, I think it is. In the new translation schools, actualization of the fundamental innate mind of clear light, simultaneous with the manifestation of the six operative consciousnesses, or you could, some other places, they're called the six primary consciousnesses, which are the five sense consciousnesses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mental consciousness, so that the clear light and the primary consciousnesses at the same time is said to be impossible in the new translation schools. So you can't have clear light and sense perception at the same time. According to the new translation schools, it is necessary first to dissolve all coarser consciousnesses to render them as though incapacitated. Only then will the fundamental mind nakedly appear. According to the new translation schools, it is impossible for coarse and subtle consciousness to occur simultaneously. So this is why when you are experiencing clear light, in the new translation schools, it's emptiness, which is, so it's the same experience as emptiness, just arrived at in a different way. But that basically the experience is of no appearances. So that's really crucial. There are no appearances, no objects, when you are experiencing clear light or emptiness in Sutrayana, especially and in new translation school. In the old translation school of the great completeness, on the other hand, it is possible to be introduced to the clear light without the sensation of the six operative consciousnesses. Whoa, that's a zinger. This is really, really crucial. Since the mind of clear light has the general character of mind as an entity of mere luminosity and knowing, the general factor of the clear light can be identified even in the midst of any coarse afflictive consciousness, such as desire or hatred. As Dodrupchen says, mere luminosity and knowing pervades all consciousnesses and can even be identified during the generation of a strong afflictive emotion without having to cease the six operative consciousnesses. Thus, the difference between the old translation school and the new translation schools is that when beginning the practice of identifying innermost awareness in the great completeness, such stoppage of the six operative consciousnesses is not necessary. Rather, leaving the coarser consciousnesses as they are, the yogi identifies the clear light. When this identification has been accomplished, it is not necessary purposely to eliminate conceptions of goodness and badness. Instead, no matter what type of conceptions may arise, it has no power of deception over the practitioner, who is able to remain one-pointedly focused on the feature of mere luminosity and knowing. I'd say the Dalai Lama knows what he's talking about. So this then, you know, you might have had the question, what happens? So here's the natural progression in the four types of mindfulness that reveal the essential nature of the path. You're working with appearances, and you see the difference, distinction between stillness of awareness and the movement of appearances. And you have the simultaneous experience of stillness and motion to arrive at one-pointedness. Then from that one-pointedness, naturally, as you remain in this non-grasping state and you're not grasping to the appearances that arise, that the volume of appearances begins to diminish, and finally they just stop. And so you reach then the third of the four types of mindfulness, the absence of mindfulness, where there are no appearances. It's just substrate. And then you go to substrate consciousness, no appearances. So are you then basically resting, if you're going to experience then pristine awareness, so which pristine awareness, and you can think of as equivalent to clear light. If you're going to experience pristine awareness or clear light, does that mean that you will never have any appearances again if you're going to just rest in clear light? Not in Dzogchen. So this is the really extraordinary thing, that you go from no appearances as a kind of intermediate accomplishment and a necessary platform, but then you go into spontaneous actualization of appearances, so that not only are there appearances, but there it's just a manifold display of, this is nirmanakaya, all of these appearances. So you have gone from, you could say, from nirvana to enlightenment. It's not that, because there is more to happen after pristine awareness, before actual enlightenment. But what you are doing is resting in a, at that point then, when you're resting in pristine awareness, very, very close facsimile of what is called non-abiding nirvana. So, it, with nirvana, you could think of as pretty, you know, the descriptions of it, and Alan goes into this in, at times, in great detail, talking about his conversation or his correspondence with Bhikkhu Bodhi, the greatest, or yeah, the greatest Theravadan translator right now, and talking about the attributes of nirvana. And so, but basically, no appearances. You know, peace, serenity, you know, bliss, perhaps, or extinction, total extinction. You take your choice among the scholars and of the Theravadan scholars. But it's basically nirvana is peace. You know, no appearances, basically. And so it seems analogous to what happens with the luminosity, non-conceptuality, and bliss of substrate consciousness. But then the non-abiding nirvana is the nirvana, or the, you could say the nirvana, non, it's the non-abiding nirvana of a fully enlightened Buddha. And so a Buddha is not content to just rest in peace and say that all of these appearances are samsaric appearances and are disturbing my peace of samsara. But the Buddha, in his omniscience, is able to rest in this non-abiding nirvana, and all of appearances in his omniscience are appearing to him, but they don't appear as samsaric appearances. Even the same appearance, in my mind, he can know that my experience of this appearance is samsaric, but it isn't a samsaric appearance to him. Why is that? Because he is resting in this state of pristine awareness, beyond pristine awareness, but it's that still has that quality of being able to see all appearances as the spontaneous display of awareness itself. So all appearances are equally pure. So you get how radical this really is, and important, this Dzogchen idea that you don't have to, all of the primary consciousnesses and sense impressions don't have to dissolve. You can still be having sense impressions. You know, you can be out here looking at the lake and basking in the sun and be resting in clear light, resting in pristine awareness. It depends on, you know, how you are viewing the appearances. So then just with the thought, giving a really quick schematic, since I don't know whether together we'll have a chance again for a long time to do this, I thought I would just outline for you how you might go about doing this approach to Vipassana, using Wangchuk Dorje's four elements of cutting through to pristine awareness. So all appearances are mind. So here's the first facet that you're going to see as you're just viewing appearances arise. All appearances are mind. So what is the nature of these appearances? So this is what we're trying to understand. So not if you're going to turn this into, if you're going to cut through appearances to understand, you have to understand their nature. So what are these appearances? Their nature is that they are mind. And so you have, so here's a little Vipassana, you know, that you can begin to do analysis to power your uncontrived experiential realization. So here we have in the Perfection of Wisdom in 20,000 lines, which is, you know, bedrock Majjhimaka text. Sabuti, a bodhisattva reviews all phenomena as similar to an apparition, a dream, a mirage, an echo, an image, a reflection of the moon in the water, a magical creation, a village of the sprites. Even nirvana, I say, is like a dream, like an illusion. If I could apprehend any phenomenon more exalted than nirvana, of that I should also say, that is like a dream, like an illusion. The Lord has said that dream and waking are indistinguishable. Ultimately, all phenomena are like a dream. So this is, you know, when all of this collapses, you know, and you have these appearances and you're seeing all the facets simultaneously, What is it going to look like? It's going to look like a lucid dream appearance. And that these are just appearances, and you know that these are dream appearances. So all, and here you have it. Ultimately, all phenomena are like a dream. And then you can get into in Dzogchen and say, it is not like a dream, it is a dream. So first of all, we awaken to the dream, and then we awaken from the dream. So we realize, first of all, that we are, that this is a dream. So we have to, because right now we're non-lucidly dreaming. So we awaken to the dream, and then we are free of the dream altogether. So recall now, in thinking about this as a template for doing simultaneous, or the fusion of shamatha and vipassana, recall the essential instructions of Mahasiddha Maitripa when he lays out the three types of shamatha. First of all, focused on signs, then on conceptualization, and then on non-conceptualization. So this simultaneous stillness and motion is shamatha focused on conceptualization. Now, let's go back and check this out, what he has to say about this again, and see if it means something more. Whatever virtuous and non-virtuous thoughts arise, steadily and non-conceptually observe their nature. By so doing, they are calmed and non-grasping. Awareness vividly arises, clear and empty, with no object of grasping, and it is sustained in the nature of self-liberation, in which it recognizes itself. All of it's becoming coherent, all this advice. But the interesting thing here is that you're observing the nature. That he's talking about shamatha practice, and he's saying observe their nature. So, but the function of observing their nature is that it calms the grasping mind. Because as a lucid dreamer, why are you going to grasp to a dream appearance? You see it for what it is. It's just a dream appearance. It can be tantalizing and all of that, but grasp to it? Because you know what it is. Again, direct the mind to whatever thoughts arise, and without acceptance or rejection, you will recognize your own nature. You know, you could read that 100 times as shamatha advice and never really get, I think, you know, what we're really talking about right now as this fusion of shamatha and vipassana, and how the vipassana practice really supports the shamatha, and then of course the shamatha is absolutely essential for the vipassana. And then just a little more of your, vipassana primer, so for you to work on to reach the uncontrived experiential realization that all appearances are mind. So in phase one, Dujam Lingpa is instructions in the outline in Essence of Clear Mind. The first point is under the path cutting through to original purity. this is the path we want to be on. So under the outline, the path cutting through to original purity, the first point is identifying the creator of all phenomena as the mind. So isn't this the point that we're trying to get? All appearances are mind. So he says here, identifying, this is what Dujam Lingpa is laying out here, or in Orgyen Dorje, or Soki Dorje outlined for him in this text. So here you have the mind is primary. So we'll just leave it at that right now and talk a little bit more about that in the next point. And then also, if you need just a little more vipassana contemplation, you know, to power again, to have the uncontrived experiential realization for this point that all appearances are mind. The Ratna Megasutra, which you find. Anyway, I got this out of when Alan taught this at Tushita, the Four Applications of Mindfulness. And for the first time he taught this particular text that I was at anyway, that he taught this particular text from Shantideva called the Compendium of Practices. But in the Ratnamegha Sutra, all phenomena are preceded by the mind. When the mind is comprehended, all phenomena are comprehended. By bringing the mind under control, all things are brought under control. Okay, so got it. Placement, analysis. Uncontrived experiential realization. Okay, move on to the next point. Mind is empty. So all appearances are mind. So there's, as Gyatso Rinpoche pointed out, there's a tendency to reify the mind then. That mind is all there is, and it is inherently real. So how do we then have the uncontrived experiential realization that mind is empty? So, first of all, in the classic approaches, seek out the source of names is really a great one to use on that. So what is the basis of designation of mind? You know, is it this thought? Is it all my thoughts? Is it my history? Is it the big warehouse of all my memories? You know, if there were such a thing. What is the basis of designation of mind? So what is this all-creating sovereign? You know, that is the creator of all phenomena. What is this mind? Where can I find it? First of all, and the way that you go about that, first of all, is that you have to know what the referent is. So what is it that you're looking for? And then see if you can find it in the basis of designation upon which you are labeling mind. So, you know, so you're asking, does mind have a self nature? Meaning, is it really there independent of causes and conditions? You know, or is it just simply another dependently originated phenomena? You know, in that which case, basically meaning another appearance. So when you go looking for mind, do you find anything other than more appearances of mind? Or is there some essence that is the actual perceiver of all appearances? Or is it just appearances? So that's the question, you know, and that's a very subtle one. And you can find all the, you know, bring in all of your own other analyses and ways of approaching this. But basically, the point that you're trying to get to is mind is empty, you know? And so there are a lot of different approaches in Majjhimagga to getting to that point. So here's one way of doing that within that Dujom Lingpa asserts. And so the first point that I mentioned under the point in essence of clear meaning, identifying the creator of all phenomena as the mind, then so first of all, you're on the path to cut through to primordial consciousness, then identifying the mind as the creator of all phenomena. So the first point under that point, that the creator of all phenomena is the mind, is that establishing the mind as baseless and rootless. And here, rootless means there's no origin, and baseless means there's no basis of designation for the mind, so which is an inherent basis of designation. And so here, he says, under this point, establishing the mind as baseless and rootless, the shape and color of the all-creating sovereign, as well as its origin, location, and destination, are objectless openness. This is the spontaneous actualization of the essential nature of the path of cutting through. So you you get that and you have the spontaneous actualization of the essential nature. So it's shape and color as well as its origin, location, and destination. Those basic questions over and over and over again. By examining in that way whether the mind that is the all-creating sovereign of the body, speech, and mind, or of all phenomena, is really existent or really non-existent, the mind is found to have no basis or root. So it is not established as having any shape or color. The five elements and five sensory objects appear like objects of the mind, and your own body appears as its base. But if all of these are investigated from an ultimate perspective, they are found to be like space, not truly established as either one thing or many. Ascertaining the origin, location, and destination of the mind as objectless openness is the spontaneous actualization of the essential nature of the path of cutting through. This is not something freshly achieved, but it is simply the knowledge of the mode of being of the nature of existence. So, you know, many different arguments and angles. But here, when you're looking at all of the different arguments and angles that you could accumulate, you know, in your spare time to work on this particular spontaneous uncontrived experiential realization that mind is empty. Keep in mind this advice from Pabongka Rinpoche in Liberation in Our Hands. And he's talking about that, first of all, you have to understand, when you're doing this analysis, you have to understand what is the referent of the object that you are trying to refute. And so what comes to mind when you think, my mind? You know, so you have to have a clear object in mind before you do your analysis. And then Pabongka Rinpoche cites Losang Chukyi Gelson, who is the fourth Panchen Lama. And this, you know, is really, really extraordinary advice. And I think it skewers a lot of approaches to emptiness. The way the object to be negated by reasoning appears to the mind is not any different from the way that entities usually appear to ordinary persons like ourselves. So when you're thinking of an object to be negated, you don't have to look very far. Just, you know, one of the ordinary appearances to a person like me and you. So this is because every mental state of an ordinary person is tainted by ignorance, and therefore every object that appears to the mind of such a person possesses the quality of appearing to be truly existent. This is really, really important. You know, and this tells you why you can do Vipassana practice with the ordinary appearances that are arising as you're doing simultaneous stillness and motion. If we don't properly discern the way objects give the appearance of being truly existent, we will end up identifying the object to be refuted as some abstract notion of self-existence that is not part of our actual experience. Having failed to recognize the object to be negated as it naturally appears in the mind, we will invent some new way of perceiving the self as the object to be negated and apply logical analysis to this, which only results in a philosophical view that was created from artificial speculation. And then, if you correctly identify this object, you can refute it easily. So the real burden or all of the work goes into identifying the object that you want to refute. And this is a mind that is self-existently the perceiver of all appearances, the thinker of the thoughts, my mind, the thinker of my thoughts, right? And then if this mind exists in the way that it appears to in these ordinary perceptions, it should be knowable. You know, so if something exists, it must be knowable and have qualities. So then what are these qualities? Where do you find, or what is the basis of designation? Again, is it my personal history? Is it my thoughts? My worst mental affliction? I am so angry. You know, that's me. You know, I am an angry person. Or I am a loving person. I am so smart. Or I am such a dolt. Or on and on and on. I am, I am, I am. So is the mind, you know, so first, and it's not even I, but it's mind we're looking at this point. And again, the power is in the analysis of seek out the source of names. So if the thing exists inherently, it should be found in the basis of designation. So if I am my body, I should be found in my body. But otherwise, if I am just a label pasted onto a body that is created by causes and conditions, that's a whole different story. Then there is an I that exists that way. You know, it's just a conceptual designation that is applied to something. But the importance of knowing that is that this I then isn't necessarily applied to this basis of designation. So, I mean, I could be all kinds of other things, and I could be not bounded by this body. I could be something much greater. I could be every person in this room. I could have equal concern for every person in this room because I am not my body. On and on and on. The ramifications are extraordinary. And then just finally, before we take a break, or two more points. This is, Lama Ellen calls this, destroying the, or seeing through the inherent existence of the mind. So mind is empty. This is the point we're trying to get. Mind is empty. This is like the Death Star, the vulnerability in the Death Star in The Empire Strikes Back, or one of those. So Luke Skywalker is flying through a ventilation tube or something, right, to get to the reactor in the Death Star, but otherwise the Death Star is impregnable. It has only this one vulnerability. And so they find the one vulnerability and attack the vulnerability. And so what is the greatest vulnerability of self-existence of all phenomena that you could imagine? If all phenomena are created by the mind, and the mind is empty, and you can prove that to yourself, what does that mean about the Death Star? Yeah, it's gone. So this is why this is such a crucial point. You know, you can't believe in the inherent existence or concrete self-existence of these appearances that can be so troubling if you know that the dreaming mind is also empty. The mind that is perceiving all of these things and is the all-creating sovereign. If the all-creating sovereign is empty, everything that it creates is empty as well. And then, Nagarjuna states in A Commentary on the Spirit of Awakening. So this one is another one of these that you can just take as an analytical meditation and grok it. You know, do it until you grok it. The mind is a mere label, and it is nothing other than a label. Recognize awareness as a mere label. Moreover, a label has no intrinsic nature. Thus, the mind is of the nature of an apparition, and the nature of the mind does not exist as any type of color or shape, as something apprehended or as an apprehended, as a man, a woman, or a neuter, and so forth. In short, the Buddhas have not seen it, and they will not see it. They accurately see it as having the nature of being without an intrinsic nature. So it has the nature of being without an intrinsic nature. And then while you are working on making, getting this uncontrived experiential realization of this point, mind is empty, the important thing is to understand the emptiness of mind as your own experience, and not as Nagarjuna's words or Chandrakirti's words, or to rely on their reasoning. This has to be your experience and your reasoning that you are proving to yourself. So let's take a break at that point, and then there is just a little bit more to say before we actually do a meditation, because there are still two more points to go. But let's freshen up and come back at 10 minutes till 3:00.